Hi, and welcome back to Spatulas and Speculations. I am your unofficial Professor Lily, and this is the unofficial SJM 101. Today, we are going to be doing part two of what we started last week. So if you haven't listened to last week's episode, go ahead, watch that, and then jump back here, because we're going to be going over everything that Nesta learned in the prison in the next chapter that they get into the conversation with Reese with when they come back from it. So it's kind of a continuation of what we started last week, but with a lot more theory and a little bit more depth into the entire SJM universe. So this will be your spoiler warning. If you haven't finished reading all of the books from SJM, all 15 books that are out into the universe currently, save this podcast, follow me, and come back and join the conversation when you are done. I'm very excited for you to come back, but we don't do spoilers in this classroom. The other thing that I want to talk about, a new warning, a seasonal warning. I am a little bit sicky. I started to get a little sicky when I was recording last time, and I had to take a break because my throat got really raw, and I just haven't really shooken it, so if I sound a little off today, that's why. And if I take a little bit more breaths than usual, when I get sick, for some reason, my lungs do not ever do well. I don't have COVID. I don't know what it is. It's been like that my entire life. I just get really winded when I get sick. For some reason, I'm not a very active person, so I think that's probably why. I'm like, my body's working like it's running marathons when usually I'm not. So I don't know what it is, but that's the way it is. The next disclaimer is, because we're just going to get them all out of the way right now before we go into my little opening spiel, is I don't speak for Sarah and I don't speak for Bloomsbury. These are my thoughts. These are my opinions. This is what I've gathered. I might miss things. I'm human. The next thing is that I do pronounce things wrong. I will be reading from a large chunk of Akasif today. I think it's only 3 pages this time, instead of like last week where it was a considerable whole chapter that we read. But it's only 3 pages. But I pronounce things wrong. I have a weird accent. I'm from the north. It's just how it is. I can't change it. I work really hard to. I'm slowly but surely going through the audiobook catalog kind of on and off again. I go through like one book and then I won't read it, or I won't listen to another one for like 3 months. So I am trying to listen to the audiobooks to get all of the pronunciation right. Though I will say, this has nothing to do with anything, I'm pretty sure someone has tried to correct me. I say Valg, and I think it's Volg, and I don't want to sound like dirty, but there is a specific woman body part that sounds like, and I'm a child at heart, and I would never be able to say Volg without giggling every 2 seconds. So it's Valg to me, and I don't know if anyone else has noticed that I had said it that way or if it bothered anyone, but I actually do know that I think it's pronounced a different way, but I refuse to accept that. There are a few pronunciations I refuse to accept, and even though I know that there is a proper way to say it, I refuse to say it that way. So there's that. So, today's episode, we're going to be doing a chapter breakdown, and then kind of middle-ish end of the chapter breakdown, we're actually going to go straight into theory mode. And I've been talking about this theory, and I was like, and I just dropped it and ran away, and I was like, someday later we'll pick it back up and talk about it. Today's the day where we're going to pick it up and talk about it, which I know has happened quite a lot on the podcast, where I'm like, one day we'll talk about it, and then one day has yet to come. One day has come. We are here together, and we're going to actually talk about it. And that theory is, and I'll just tell it to you now so you have something to look forward to towards the end and you actually listen to all of my stuff, is I think that Reese's High Lord form is actually a word hound. And I mentioned it a while, like I think 3 or 4 weeks ago, and now we're going to pick it up because it gets mentioned in here and I think it's a perfect time to talk about it. Though I bounced back and forth whether I wanted to do the entire deep dive of it today or if I wanted to save it for when I do Reese's one day, another one day, we will talk about it. we do Reese's character deep dive, but I think that Reese's character deep dive is already going to be considerably massive without me having to do I think it's probably going to end up being like a 10-minute talk on this whole theory when we break it down and read from all the stuff and just kind of talk it out. So I think that putting it in here now, and then I'll probably make a TikTok on it sometime this week, we'll have it out into the ether, and that way when we do Reese's character deep dive, you'll know what I say when I say, and I think his High Lord form is a word hound, and then I'm just going to kind of move on, and we'll just have a you can just go back, whatever, and it'll be there. And we can just talk about all of the other stuff that I'd rather talk about. His powers, his family, his cold magic, because Reese also has cold magic, but it's very, very subtle. Why am I talking about it now? I have an issue with this. I need someone who's, like, in the room with me while I record to just, like, spray me with water every time I get off topic. So today we are going to be doing A Court of Silver Flames, Chapter 55. This is right when they come back from the prison, and Nesta and Cassian have some questions for Reese that, surprise, surprise, he actually answers. It is an SJM miracle. Someone asks an intelligent question, and it gets answered. It's amazing. It's never happened before. So this is a cool episode, except... There's a little line in here. So we do get an answer, but it could be a wrong answer, which is, it's amazing that Sarah could make me so happy, but also make me so infuriated at the same time. But let's just get into it. We'll talk about that in a second. Here we go. We're going to start a little bit after they come in from the prison, because there's just that little moment with her, with Farah and Nesta. And I just feel like I don't really need to read it. It doesn't really, like, I do like to read the, try and get you the entire ambiance of a section, and I try to read, like, a little sentence before and a little sentence after, even in tiny chunks, so that way you can feel that I am not in any way twisting information to benefit a thought that I've had. I have this issue, it's my podcast, I can talk however I want. There's been a lot of, some specific theories that are going around, and I get a lot of people asking me on my opinion of them, but my biggest problem with some of these theories, or with theories in general in the SJM universe, is if someone doesn't give you the chapter or the direct quote that they're coming from, and so you can't fact check them, and the reason why I almost am obnoxious on chapter numbers and context, and I always go in a little spiel, this is when this is happening, or this is chapter, 30 of Queen of Shadows, and in this chapter, these are the characters who are there, this is what's happening, is so that you can really, one, you can fact check me, always, always, always feel free to fact check me. If you think that I'm saying something wrong, or if I'm missing a piece of something, or I'm not getting the full grasp of a quote or of a topic, feel free to fact check me. I would love for people to fact check me. But if you're going to fact check me, you have to promise that you're going to actually read from what I have read from. That's why I always give you direct quote, because I have some people going, no, word marks never looked like that. And then I go, well, in the video that I was talking about this, I actually gave you, direct chapter numbers and moments where the word marks were actually looked like that. And they go, oh, I never noticed that. Or I didn't read it like that. And I was like, well, fact check me, but fact check me right. So with theories, I actually think you should put your guard up a little bit with some theories if they're not giving you direct canon evidence to support their theory. And I see a lot of them that are pertaining to myth. And the important thing with Sarah J. Maas is, yes, she pulls a lot from myth, but she has never done a direct, verbatim myth retelling. So just because there may be myth elements, I wouldn't say X, Y, and Z is definitely this because of this mythology. Sarah's never really done a direct, straight mythology retelling. She kind of just, she gives you echoes of mythology in her books, and I think that's the best way to do it, because you're getting the inspiration, but you're not a direct retelling. She is not Song of Achilles, she's not Circe, she's not anything like that. I mean, really, A Court of Thorns and Roses isn't even slightly a Beauty and the Beast retelling, in my opinion. Yes, there is a beast, and yes, there's a beauty and a library, but Farah can't even read. She is not Belle. While I'm not going to start from the very beginning of this chapter, and I'm not going to read the entire chapter through, I am going to read a little bit before we're going to start our breakdown, and then I'll read a tiny bit after where we're going to finish our breakdown, just so you can get the full section and what I'm saying. And that's why I do it. So if you ever feel like I'm being a little winded in my quotes or when I'm pulling from things, just know that I'm doing it to just protect me and protect you and the knowledge that you're absorbing. The thing with theory is we could all be wrong, and I think you have a less likely chance of being wrong with the more canon evidence you present. So there we go. There's my little spiel. be wary if someone is talking theory, but do not give you any direct canon evidence or does not give you direct chapter numbers or even page numbers. Though I was told when I first started doing theories, I used to do page numbers, and I stopped fairly into my theorying because someone's like, well, hardcover page numbers are going to be different. International page numbers are going to be different. So that's why I always give you chapter numbers. And then that's also why I give you, and this is where in the chapter we're going to be reading from, because, you know, some of the chapters are like 20 pages long. You have to flip through 20 pages just for one line. That's kind of ridiculous. So there's that. So here we go. This is in Nesta's perspective, and they're in the river house. They have, I think some time has passed because Cassian did have a cracked skull, a broken arm, and some small cuts, but they seem to have been healed by now. Nesta's in the room with Rhys, Cassian, and Farrah. I don't think... Yeah, Azriel's not even in the room. Amryn's not there, which I kind of think is interesting that Az is not there. I don't know why I find that interesting, but I do find that interesting. So it's just Rhys, Farrah, Cassian, and Nesta talking about this. I kind of wish Amryn was there because I feel like she'd be able to give a lot of input on the history that they're talking about. And also, as you're going to see, I have some questions for Amryn that get raised in this chapter, and we're going to talk about them. So without further ado, I'm going to shut up now. Well, I'm not going to shut up, but I'm going to go back on topic, and I'm going to just read to you the section and then do the breakdown like I'm supposed to be doing and not doing the breakdown before I do the reading because you have no idea what I'm talking about. Nesta tried not to sag. She intended to ask about the baby, but Rhys turned to her and said, "Put the harp on the desk, Nesta." "It allowed you to winnow within and outside of the prison," Farrah said, peering at the harp. "I suppose, because it's made, it exists beyond the rules of ordinary magic." She glanced to Rhys, who shrugged. Farrah's mouth pursed. "If any of our enemies got their hands on this, they'd use it against us in a heartbeat. No wards around this house, the House of Wind, or any of our caches or other hiding places would be safe. Not to mention that the harp seems to have a will of its own, a desire to stir up trouble. We can't plant it back in the prison, not now that it's been awakened." Rhys rubbed his jaw. "So we lock it up with the mask, ward it and spell it so it can't act out again." "I'd keep them separate," Farrah advised. "Remember what happened when the halves of the book were near each other? And why make it easier for our enemies to get both of them?" "Good point," Cassian said, wincing, as if the words made his skull ache. Maja had healed the hairline fracture just above his temple, but he'd be in pain for a few days. And his broken arm was healed, but still delicate enough to require care. The sight of all the bandages was enough to make Nesta wish she could kill Lanthes again. Rhys drummed his finger on the desk, surveying the harp. Then he asked Nesta, "Beyond seeing Breelin, you said you also saw something when you first touched the harp." Nesta had briefly explained what had happened when they had arrived. "I think whoever used it last did something horrible with it. Maybe trapped the people who once lived on the prison island in the walls somehow." "Is that possible?" Doubt shone in Rhys's eyes. Nesta asked, "What is the Wild Hunt?" She also told him of their encounters with Lanthes and the presence of the Autumn Court soldiers. Cassian had convinced Rhys not to engage with them, at least until they could deal with Breelin. When Rhys had raised his shields around the prison once more, they'd already vanished. Rhys blew out a breath, leaning back into his chair. "Honestly, I thought it was mere myth. That Lanthes remembers such things? Well, there's always room for lying, I suppose, but on the off chance he was telling the truth, that'd make him more than 15,000 years old," Farrah asked. "So what is it then?" Rhys lifted a hand, and a book of legends from the shelf beyond him floated to his fingers. He laid it upon the desk. He flipped it open to a page revealing an image of a group of tall, strange-looking beings with crowns atop their heads. "The Fae were not the first masters of this world. According to our oldest legends, most now forgotten, we were created by beings who were near gods and monsters, the Daglin. They ruled for a millennia, enslaving us and the humans. They were petty and cruel and drank the magic of the land like wine." Rhys's eyes flicked to Ataraxia, then to Cassian. "Some strains of the mythology claim that one of the Fae heroes who rose up to overthrow them was Finan, who was given the greatsword Gwydion by the High Priestess Oleana. who had dipped it into the cauldron itself. Finan and Gwydion overthrew the Daglin. A millennia of peace followed, and the land was divided into the rough territories that were predecessors to Quartz. But at the end of those 1,000 years, they were at each other's throats, and on the brink of war. His face tightened. Finan unified them and set himself above them as High King, the first and only High King this land has ever had. Nesta could have sworn the last words were spoken with a sharp look towards Cassian, but Cassian only winked at Rhys. What happened to the High King? Rhys ran a hand over the page of the book. Finan was betrayed by his queen, who had been a leader of her own territory, and by his dearest friend, who was his general. They killed him, taking some of his bloodline's most powerful and precious weapons, and then out of the chaos that followed, the 7 High Lords rose, and the courts have been in place ever since. Farrah asked, Does Amryn remember this? Rhys shook his head. Only vaguely now. From what I've gleaned, she arrived during those years before Finan and Gwydion rose, and went into the prison during the Age of Legends, the time when this land was full of heroic figures who were keen to hunt down the last members of their former master's race. They feared Amryn, believing her one of their enemies, and threw her into the prison. When she emerged again, she had missed Finan's fall and the loss of Gwydion, and found the High Lord's ruling. Nesta considered all Lanthes had said. And what is Nerebin? Lanthes asked about that? He said my sword isn't Nerebin. He sounded surprised. Rhys studied her blade. Nerebin is a death sword. It's lost, probably destroyed, but other stories say it can slay even monsters like Lanthes. So can Nesta's sword, apparently, Farrah said, studying the blade as well. Beheading him with it killed him, Rhys mused. A slice from it seemed to bind him to his physical form, Nesta corrected. Cassian's dagger struck true only after Lanthes had been forced to give up his mist. Interesting, Rhys muttered. Cassian said, You still haven't explained the Wild Hunt. Rhys turned a few pages in the book to an illustration of a host of riders on horses and all manner of beasts. The Daglin delighted in terrorizing the Fae and humans under their control. The Wild Hunt was a way to keep us all in line. They gathered a host of their fiercest, most merciless warriors and granted them free rein to kill as they pleased. The Daglin possessed mighty, monstrous beasts. Hounds, they called them, though they didn't look like hounds, we know them. And they used to run prey into the ground before they tortured and killed them. It's a terrible history, and much of it might be elaborated myths. The hounds look like the beast in Hewan City, Nesta said quietly, and they all looked to her. She admitted, Lanthes showed me a vision of what he and I might be together. We ruled in a palace, king and queen with the trove, and at our feet sat those hounds. They looked like the scaled beasts carved into Hewan City's pillars. Even Rhys had no answer to that. Cassian's jaw tightened. So even while he tried to kill you, he was trying to seduce you? Nesta's stomach churned. She refrained from mentioning how graphic the visions had been. There was a fourth object in the vision, but it was in shadow. Was there ever a fourth part of the trove? All I could make out was an ancient bit of bone. Rhys ran a hand through his dark hair. As far as the history confirmed, there was only 3 objects in the trove. Farrah asked, What if it's protected by a spell, like the one to shield all thought of the trove to keep people from ever knowing about the fourth object? Rhys's eyes shadow. Then Mother spare us, because even Amryn only vaguely remembers a rumor of it. And then I'm going to stop here. They end up just going off talking about Iris and saying how they should have listened to him. And in my book that I'm actually reading from, I have it like underlined and highlighted. No shit, let the man speak, please. Because throughout the entire book, Iris is trying to ask questions about what's under Ramiel or, you know, kind of existential bigger picture things that he knows more about. And I think I go on this spiel every time we end up talking about Akasif, but it drives me insane because they're literally like, oh, Iris was probably right. And I'm like, yeah, no kidding. Let the man speak for once in his life. He actually has something to say. And then they talk about the dance that ends up happening in the Court of Nightmares. So let's do the breakdown of what we just read. The first thing that gets mentioned in the section that we just read is the harp's ability to maneuver around normal magic. it can go through wards and whatever. And I really don't want to talk about the HARP today. I want to do a whole episode dedicated to the Trove, the history of the Trove, and all that stuff. And I'm probably going to do it later on down the line, unless I run out of content. But the reason I don't want to talk about it today is because I could do a whole episode on it, and I want to give it all the time that it requires. I will say that they do talk about a fourth item in the Trove further down, and there is only one mention in all of Crescent City on what the horn truly looked like before it was in Bryce's back, and it does say it was a bit of aged bone. I couldn't find it for this episode, but to be honest, I didn't really look because I knew I wasn't going to talk much on it. So it's 100, I wouldn't say 100% because, you know, there's always wiggle room, but it's probably a 99% chance that it is the fourth object in the Trove. And we'll talk about it in its own time later on. So the true first thing I want to talk about is what she says about the harp last being used. And I talked about it last week, but I think it's doubly confirmed that the people aren't trapped in the prison. And the reason why is I think Rhys knows a lot more than he ever lets on truly, and I think he can feel more than he ever lets on truly, like magically wise. And when she says, I think whoever used it last did something horrible with it, maybe trapped the people who once lived on the prison island in the wall somehow, is that possible? So she says, maybe. It's not definite. The thing about some of the SJM characters is they do theorize quite a bit, and they only theorize with the knowledge that they have at hand, and sometimes they are wrong. And I think this is kind of one of those moments where she's theorizing and there's doubt in Rhys's eyes. Rhys knows the prison really well. He knows the history of the prison really well, and he knows the bone carver fairly well. I think that he would know if there was a heavy presence. I would say, like, I want to talk about, like, it's haunted, you know, like, people, like, there's a heavy presence in this old house. But, like, the prison is an old house, and I don't think that there are, like, spirits in it, like, trapped. And we talked about it last week. We went on a whole thing about the gates and stuff. So I think it's pretty solidified in my mind that what she felt when she touched the harp was the people getting trapped on Midgard rather than being trapped at the prison, but that the prison was an access point that Regulus talks about in 73. And there's something that gets brought up, and we're going to talk about it a little bit further down, and I think I've mentioned it kind of maybe even last week, but definitely before, is the bone carver chose to be in the prison, right? And I kind of wonder, as it gets brought up later when we talk about the word hounds were placed in Rifthold to guard the access point there that Elena uses. I kind of wonder if the bone carver was placed there to guard the access point like those beasts. So she felt the prison, you know, whatever, shut. I kind of wonder if the bone carver was there just like making sure that nobody opened it or nothing came through. The same thought that I have with like Bryaxis and how he was kind of placed in the library for a reason. I don't know. It seems a little sus. So they end up moving down to talk about Lanthes. They say that he's 15,000 years old. That would check for when 15,000 years ago is with the history that we get with like Thea, Finan, and Peleus. So it kind of makes sense that Lanthes would be around that time. I think it's interesting that he's like, well, he could be lying, but I'm like, well, Amran's over 15,000 years old, the bone carver's over 15,000 years old, Striga's over 15,000 years old, Koshi's over 15,000 years old. Like, there's enough people in Perithian over the age of 15,000 years old, and Lanthes gives off being one of them. So I think it's weird that he was like, well, he could be lying. I'm like, why would he lie about that? So they go on to talk about, well, he opens up this book, and this particular book is one strain of mythology. So when we talk about everything that's going on in this chapter, I want you to kind of wink at Sarah, like hint, hint, nudge, nudge, like I know what you're doing. And she says some strains of mythology, and I think she does this for a few reasons, one of them being she's kind of covering her butt a little bit. So, like, say later when she's going to write, you know, the actual truth of what's happening, and we can't just be like, oh, Goop, but you said in this chapter this, but really, in this chapter, it's just some strains of mythology, it's not true history, and we kind of see that when he talks about the Daglin, and he says, they created us when we have the cauldron, and we know of the mother, and the mother was what created Fae. So I think it's really, this whole chapter is really interesting to me, because we do have a history and how the Fae were created, how Perithian were created, so why can you say that the Daglin created them when we know the mother did, and we actually have the object of creation in your possession, or was in your possession. So I think it's interesting. But when talking about the Daglin, he says, he flipped it open, revealing an image of a group of tall, strange-looking beings with crowns atop their heads. So strange-looking mean they don't look like, you know, quote-unquote, the Vanir, like the Asteri do in Crescent City. They're not Fae-looking. They don't look like High Fae, which I think really just stands out to me is, and I've, you know, this is why I kind of wanted to go from this topic to doing a episode deep diving into everything we know about the Asteri, is because I think it flows really well. But I think I'm going to put a pause in that because I have been requested to do some more theories, and someone actually asked me to do a specific theory on something, and I do have a whole bunch of notes on that specific theory, so we're going to do that next week, and then maybe we'll do the Asteri, or we'll do our character deep dive. We'll see how I feel when putting my notes together for the week. We know that the Asteri can shapeshift or take multiple different forms. We don't really know if they can shapeshift. I feel like probably they can shapeshift because Regulus turns into Cat Atis, or Regulus took over a cat that looked like Cat Atis, or it was an illusion. Like, we don't really know if it's shape-shifting, or if it's possession, or illusion, or what. But we do know that the Asteri on Midgard take multiple forms. They had multiple forms throughout all 15,000 years that they have been ruling on Midgard. They have statues of their different forms in the palace that they're in. So, this group of strange-looking beings with crowns atop their heads, this could be they were taking the form of whatever was, you know, hottest off the press kind of thing, like the best looking at the time or the most powerful looking at the time. There could have been a lot more OG Valgs on Perithian at that time, so they're like, well, we need to be like those creatures because they're stronger than the Fae, and now in Crescent City, they're like, we need to look more like them and kind of blend in more than we have in the past kind of thing. That's how I see it. But regardless, this little section reminds me of a few reasons of this section in Tower of Dawn when Yurine is first looking into the Songs of Beginnings and she first learns the names of the three Valg kings, the wielders of the keys. And it says this, she flipped through the pages until the next illustration appeared. Three figures stood before the same gate, the drawing too distant to make out any features beyond their male bodies, tall and powerful. She ran a finger over the caption below and translated, Orcreus, Manitix, Erwin, the three Valg kings, wielder of the keys. So, there's kind of this interesting parallel, similar wording here, revealing an image of tall, just like tall males, strange-looking beings with crowns atop their heads. In Queen of Shadows 30, when Dorian is being possessed, there's this one little short chapter in the middle of Queen of Shadows that kind of lingers with me forever and ever, and we've talked about it before on this page, and I think we've talked about it even in this context, and I'm going to bring it up again, just like kind of hammer in these details that I think are important. And it says this in Queen of Shadows 30, there are pedestals arranged in the room in an elegant curve, each topped with a black pillow, and on each pillow sat a crown, kept down here like trophies, kept in darkness like him. A secret room. The prince stood at the center of it, surveying the crowns. The demon had taken control of the body completely. He let him. After that woman with the familiar eyes had failed to kill him, he waited for the demon to leave the room. But the demon prince spoke instead. a hissing, cold voice that came from between the stars, speaking to him, only to him. "The crowns of conquered nations," the demon prince said. "More will be added soon. Perhaps the crowns of other worlds, too." He did not care. "You should care. You will enjoy it as we rip the realms to shreds." I just feel like you could say the crowns of conquered nations, as in the nations of, you know, Aurelia that were conquered. But, I mean, there's really no mention of these crowns being anything, like, anything to do with these other ones. And they're kept down there like trophies, so I kind of wonder if they're like Valg relics from when they conquered their planet or when they were conquering other planets. Because we know that the three Valg kings went to other worlds before they ended up in Aurelia. So they could have kept their crowns from when they were in other places. We also know from the timeline that we did of Throne of Glass and how I will be talking kind of more or less from now on that Throne of Glass happened 15,000 years ago. That this would line up with the timelines for these beings with crowns atop their heads, and then the Valg kings coming in with these crowns that from other worlds, conquered nations, you know, ripping realms to shreds. So the illustrations kind of mirroring each other timeline-wise as well. We also never truly see a Valg in Throne of Glass in its true form. We see a tiny little essence of it when Yurine is killing Erwin, but it's not really his full form. He's just kind of Voldemort squish baby in Harry's mind. Was that a niche metaphor? But it was worded very similarly. But we don't really see the Valg in their true form. So these group of tall, strange-looking beings with crown atop their heads, could they be Valg kings? This is actually an interesting episode because we're going to get into the Asteri Valg, Daglin Valg, Prince of Hell Valg debate, and you'll see why in a few seconds, actually. But this is where it starts off. Like, so the Valg can shapeshift. The Valg kings can shapeshift. They can take whatever form they want, basically. The Asteri can do the same thing. Strange-looking beings with crown atop their head, kind of similar to the Valg. We know Lanthes could take whatever form he wanted. He has black blood. It's kind of like, okay, Lanthes is probably Valg. We know that Strigga had some control over how she appeared. She had black blood. She was Valg. The Bone Carver could take any form you needed to hear the truth from, in my opinion, but he could take many different forms. So, and he is the blood twin of the Weaver, Strigga. So it's kind of assuming he has black blood as well. We have never seen Khoshi. We don't know what Khoshi looks like, so we can put a little question mark around him, but I'm gonna assume he can take whatever form he wants, and I assume from... I have a TikTok on this, but Khoshi's hot in my mind. He is a sexy Death Lord. That's just in my brain. That's how I have him. From canon evidence, there is evidence to support this backup, but they can take other forms, just like the Valg kings, just like the Asteri. So, to get onto the conversation, are the Daglin Asteri, or, you know, this is one of those topics that I kind of like, it's like a top-down tree. This is when I wish I could send you guys pictures or show you a video of what my hands are doing currently, but it's like, Valg, and then like a little branch, Asteri, and then like, in the middle, Daglin, question mark, and then, like, kind of at the bottom, kind of pointing both ways is Princes of Hell, and, you know, we just have, like, things that match. Maybe I should make a graft. Maybe that's what I'll do. Maybe I'll make a graft and, like, post it somewhere. But I've always been under the impression that the Daglin were Asteri because of what Regulus says in Hosab 73, Can't you? A cold voice slithered through the intercom. You are starborn. You have the horn bound to your body in power. Your ancestors wielded the horn and other fey objects that allowed them to enter this world, stolen, of course, from their original masters, our people who built fearsome warriors to be their army, all of them prototypes to the angels in this one, all of them traitors to their creators, joining the fey to overthrow my brothers and sisters 1,000 years before we arrived on Midgard. They slew my siblings. We have done the entire Crescent City 15,000 years ago timeline. It does line up with the story that Rhys tells us about the Daglin. But sibling doesn't always mean the same. I don't look anything like my siblings. I get constantly asked if I am adopted. Or the Asiri on Midgard have found a way to take powers from people, sort of like the Valg. Actually, that makes so much sense because when we talk about First Light in a second, we learn in Throne of Glass that when that First Light can gift magic, right? Or can take magic from people. So if the Asiri took enough First Light from Starborn people, could they then have the Starborn magic in them if they keep replenishing the First Light to cycle through? That makes sense. Could the Asiri possess the bodies of the Thunderbirds? That could make some sense. Could the Daglin of Perithian have taken the powers or kept dark powers? Like, there's so much wiggle room in this conversation. And there's not a lot of information to help create borders for us to go off of. But I think it is interesting that they say that the Daglin created us when we have the mother the whole time. The whole time. Like, we have the mother. So, whatever. We're going to just move on to what they say about how they were petty and cruel and drank the magic of the land like wine. This particular phrase is what brings me to, are the Asiri Valg or are the Daglin a different type of Asiri, something like that. Because this particular phrase, like wine, this happens throughout Throne of Glass, and I'll just bring up these moments for you. In Air of Fire 47, when the Valg prince is talking with Aelin, she's Selaena at this time, he says, "So gentle those icy fingers, as his thumb brushed her neck, as he tilted her face up to better stare into her eyes. Your agony tasted like wine," he murmured, peering into the core of her. In Queen of Shadows 7, they feed on it, fear, misery, despair. It's like wine to them. And then in Hosab 39, it says this about Thanatos. "It has been a long while since a mortal fly buzzed all the way down to hell. I will taste of this one's soul as I once sipped from them like fine wine." Now this phrase, like wine, happens twice in ACOTAR, other than this time it's talked about in Silver Flames. And it's when Farah is coming back to life. So the first time we get it is in ACOTAR 47, and she says, "Everything was black and warm and thick. Inky, but bordered with gold. I was swimming, kicking to the surface where Tamlin was waiting for me. Where life was waiting. Up and up, frantic for air, the golden light grew, the darkness became like sparkling wine, easier to swim through, the bubbles fizzing around me." And then there's a dash that stops her thought. Now that's kind of this is important, because in Akamath 18, when she's retelling this to the Bone Carver, he asks, "But was there anyone there? Were you seeing anything beyond? There was only that bond in the darkness." Rhysand's face had gone pale, his mouth a tight line. "And when I was made anew," I said, "I followed that bond back to me. I knew that home was on the other end of it. There was a light then, like swimming up through sparkling wine." And then there's a dash because he cuts her off. Which I'm like, why is there a dash at the exact same time with the exact same phrase? And he asks, "Were you afraid?" And then it kind of moves on. First Light is described kind of like a crystally, lighty, glowwormy type of glittery. I kind of imagine it like a glittery bomb kind of thing. When Farah is gifted by the High Lords, and even in ACOR, when Rhys is saved by the High Lords and Farah, it's like this little seed of sparkly light. In Kingdom of Ash when Dorian takes the seed of power from the spider. It's described the same way. And both of these hold magic. When Farrah was given those little seeds, she ended up getting a bit of magic from each of the High Lords. When the spider had that little seed of magic in her, she was able to use the shapeshifter's abilities, and when the seed was let back into the ether, it went back to its original owner, and Lysandra's uncle was able to have his youth back and a bit of the fullness of his magic back. So, First Light is magic, basically, and we kind of get that in the Bone Quarter when he talks about how mortals don't, like, the only judgment that they get is how much magic a person has. So when the boat sinks, it means that they don't have a lot of magic, and when the boat kind of just goes through, that means they have enough magic to be useful in the afterlife for the Asteria and the Underking to be feeding on. Does that make any sense? Does this long-winded me going through all of this make any sense? So drinking magic, like wine, the Valg only possess and feed off of, for the most part, I think only, the Valg only feed off of magic users or people who have magic in their blood. The Asteri only have use for magical beings. They kind of bred their own perfect little food palette, but it's been watering down, but we'll talk about that some other time. So they're both considered parasites. They're both feeding on basically similar things, but maybe going about it a little bit differently. So this is where that conversation kind of gets all mixed up with. And then we have Thanatos. Thanatos, who is saying he ate from them too, kind of like the Asteri eating from them. Which brings me to a theory. Well, this kind of all brings me to a few theories, but this kind of brings me to this theory that black blood might not mean Valg. Black blood just might mean a being who eats magic or eats magical essence, and that the blood is kind of like the black blood is just this a reaction. So the color of their blood turns when they learn how to eat magic. And I think this comes from when the Bone Carver says, "My sister figured out a way to eat life itself," and he doesn't. So I don't talk about this theory a lot because I don't have a lot of evidence for it, because throughout Throne of Glass, they just said black blood equals Valg. And so in my head, whenever I see someone with black blood, I just go Valg. But, Adis points out that there are creatures of other worlds who have black blood, because in Crescent City, there are creatures who spray black blood, but they're not necessarily Valg, or they're not necessarily Princes of Hell pets. So this black blood isn't just from one race. It kind of comes from a few different races. And I think, that's where my half-baked theory comes from, is that black blood could not always mean Valg. It could just mean magic eaters, which would mean there is an opening for, you know, just because they have black blood doesn't mean they're Valg. So that would mean the Asteri aren't Valg. That's what I'm trying to say. So just because the Valg do something very similar to the Asteri and they all have black blood, it could just be a reaction to eating magic, is what I'm trying to say. And I could not for the life of me say that in a cohesive way for 9 minutes or however long I just went off for. But what I do think is interesting is that both the Asteri and the Valg are considered parasites, especially throughout the ending of Throne of Glass. The word parasite gets thrown around quite a bit, so I almost wonder if that was intentional. Tower of Dawn was very important for a reason, I think, to the multiverse, and I think that's because we might have some Valg overlapping. And when they're talking about the Wild Hunt, they're saying how they had their fiercest warriors ride front and center. So this could actually kind of go through the Valg homeworld was always at war, and they turned their planet the way they turned it. I've mentioned it before. I kind of think that maybe if the Valg and the Asteri are not the same thing, then they have met before. And I wonder if when they did meet before, that some of these creatures kind of went with some of the siblings, and they, like, rode as their number one, you know, bodyguards. And that's how we have Valg-like creatures in Perithian. And that's who rode the Wild Hunt for their masters. So, did that make sense? I feel like it might be my little sick brain. I'm gonna move on now, because that's something I feel like I should just have that as a whole episode, but it's there. We're doing a chapter breakdown, so we just kind of talk about everything that comes out to me. The next thing is something that a lot of people have asked for my comment on, and it's about the High King thing, and how they say the first and only High King this land has ever had, and then Nesta could have sworn the last words were spoken with a sharp look towards Cassian, but Cassian only winked at Rhys. And I think that this, you know, it could be foreshadowing, but I think it's also just a drawback to the conversation they had earlier in A Court of Silver Flame, when Amrhen was kind of pushing Rhys because it was his birthright. But if it's Rhys's birthright, then it's also Nyx's birthright. So I think if I could have like one of those little presidential buttons, but have it just say Nyx for High King, or like I vote Nyx as High King kind of thing, like that's where my political court ACOTAR self is, Nyx as High King. So I see what people say when they're like, that was really sus, but I really think it was just Cassian, because Cassian was with Amrhen. He was like, you're the only person I would let rule. I think that was just what that moment was. I wouldn't say it was anything deeper than that, in my opinion. The next thing we have here is that Finan was betrayed by his queen, who had been a leader of her own territory. In Hosap 73, it says, if it's any interest to you, Starborn, your line specifically hailed from a small isles a few miles from the mainland. While the mainland had all manners of climes, the isle existed in near permanent twilight. And that so Duskort, obviously, they're talking about Thea. Thea ruled the Duskort Fae. But then they talk about Finan's most precious and powerful weapons. I kind of go back and forth on, was the trove Fae made, or was it made by the Daglin? And is there another trove made by the Fae with made items, like the item that's on Krita that was used to bring Miriam back? But that's all I really have to say on that, because I want to do a whole episode on the trove, and I don't want to talk too much about something we're going to talk about later on. But it brings me, like, this whole thing just kind of, Farrah asked, does Amrhen remember this? And I really do want to know, does Amrhen remember the Dusk Court? Is there a reason why she's not here for this conversation? Because Amrhen is disturbed by Starfall, and we talked about it in the Starfall episode, the first episode we ever did. So Amrhen knows what's happening. She won't talk about the prison. She won't talk about anything, really. She's like, she doesn't talk about literally anything. I almost wonder if it's because nobody ever really asks her. But I really wonder, like, what Amrhen could say about the Daglin. Because she says that she thinks her father opened the rift for her as a gift. And the Valg Kings were wielder of the keys. We know that the Asteri were able to kind of move through the rifts and move through worlds. So we're back to the Asteri-Valg kind of debate, how there's a lot of parallels between them. So I feel like she would have a lot to say in this conversation. And I'm like, why did nobody call her for it? Makes me want to strangle Rhys again. I often do. I think about it. But sometimes it's for fun. Sometimes it's for rage. Today it's rage. They end up talking about Narabin, and there are a few swords. I think there is a possibility to be Narabin. One of my favorite things to think about when I am sad and depressed is the image of Amarantha throwing a childlike hissy fit and chucking an inanimate object into the water because it wouldn't do what she wanted. And I live for that image. It stays with me constantly, always. But that means with waterways, water being in mythology, being able to go through worlds, all that stuff, that this sword could have possibly been somewhere else in the universe. I think it will probably, if it's going to be in somewhere else other than in Perithian, it'll probably be in Aurelia. And that would mean it could be Damaris, Goldrin, or the sword that Nezrin finds. The sword that Nezrin finds was hanging around a rift. Goldrin was by water. Probably not Damaris, but I want to say it was Damaris because I think Damaris, Gwydion, and Truth Teller all kind of tie together. But I think it's more likely to be either the sword that Nezrin finds or Goldrin. But Narabin was supposed to have some unholy light. It's just kind of like up in the air. But we do have a missing death sword, and I think it'll probably show up somewhere else. But let's talk about the big theory. Let's talk about Reese's High Lord form and get really deep and dark into it. So the theory comes from this chapter particularly because she ends up saying hounds that don't look like hounds, but they don't really have anything else to call them. And I was like, what does that remind me of? Where did I hear that from? That's like a direct quote from somewhere else in the SJM universe. And it clicked. And I was like, it's when Aelin is in the sewers spying on the Val commander, and he's talking to those gargoyle things, and she's like, hounds that aren't hounds, and she ends up coming up with the name Wordhound. We'll talk about that in a second. There's things I could talk about the word word and how it gets used in Throne of Glass very willy-nilly, and I'm like, can we not use it willy-nilly, because I genuinely need to know what's the difference between a word key, which is the stone from the word gate, and word stone, because obviously if word stone is the same as, I could cry about that forever, but I'm not going to. So the first time we see Reese in his true High Lord form is in Akkor 74, and it says this is in Ferris' perspective. She is holding onto the cauldron is zooming around looking for something. Everyone thinks it was Nesta. I think it was actually Elaine, because only when it finds Elaine does it stop looking for something. We'll talk about it when we talk about Elaine. I think Elaine will probably be the first person we do a character deep dive on. But maybe I'll do a poll on my Instagram this week asking. So if you don't follow me on Instagram, go ahead and follow me on Instagram, because then you can have some input on what I do next for this. Well, next week is a theory, but the week after that. I saw him assess the field ahead and transform. The talons came first, replacing fingers and feet. Then, dark scales, or perhaps feathers, I couldn't get a good look at them, covered his legs, his arms, his chest, his body contorted, bones and muscles growing and shifting, the beast form Reese had kept hidden, never liked to unleash, unless it was dire enough to do so. Before the cauldron swept me away, I beheld what happened to his head, his face. It was the thing of nightmares. Nothing human or fey in it. It was a creature that lived in black pits and only emerged at night to hunt and feast. The face. It was those creatures that had been carved into the rock of the Court of Nightmares. That made up his throne. The throne not only represented his power, but what lurked within. And with the wings, .. And then it cuts off to talk about Helion. So we see these great scaled beasts in Akamaf 42. And she says, great scaled black beasts were carved into those gates, all coiled together in a nest of claws and fangs, sleeping and fighting, some locked into the endless cycle of devouring each other. Between them flowed vines of jasmine and moonflowers. I could have sworn the beasts seemed to writhe in the silverly glow of the bobbing fey lights throughout the mountain city, the gates of eternity. That's what I'd call the painting that flickered in my mind. And then later in the chapter, it says, we at last stopped at the throne room of polished ebony. More of the serpents from the front gates were carved there, this time wrapped around countless columns supporting the onyx ceiling. It was so high up that the gloom hid the finer details. But I knew more had been carved there, too. Great beasts to monitor the manipulations and scheming within the room. The throne itself had been fashioned out of a few of them, the head snaking around either side as if watching over the High Lord's shoulder. And as a bonus, I have two things to add. In this chapter, when Cassian and Azriel come out, she says that somehow they reminded me of the ebony beast carved into the pillar they passed. So I think it's, you know, there's something there. There's something there that the Illyrians kind of all mirror these, especially with their wings, mirror these Valg-like creatures. And I'm going to leave it at that because I don't want to go too far. I want to just talk about Reese. And as an extra added bonus, when in chapter 55 of Akamaf, when they're solidifying their mating bond, Reese says, when a couple accepts their mating bond, it's overwhelming. Again, harking back to the beasts we once were. It also kind of like makes me think about how the Fae in Tog have animal forms and like the Perithian Fae don't. I wonder if it's like kind of been like quote unquote bred out of them. So then we learn that these beasts rode the wild hunt and carved into the Hewan City pillars. And I think it's interesting that it says even Reese had no answer to that and Cassian's jaw tightened because they both know that Reese's High Lord form and their wings remind her or look exactly like the beast, Hue and City. In Hosab 73, Regulus says they build fearsome warriors. I mean, come on. Maybe that'll be an episode that we do, too, of theory talk, because I know people are wanting my theories again. But what did the... Okay, Illyrians tied to those creatures at the Wild Hunt, but how can you say they are word hounds? Well, in Queen of Shadows 27, when Aelin first really sees one, she says this: "The stone creature, its black stone body jutting through the water with hardly a ripple. The Valk commander knelt before it, head down, not moving a muscle, as the horror uncoiled to its full height. Her heart leapt with a wild beat. She willed it to calm as she took in the details of the creature that now stood waist-deep in the pool, water dripping from its massive arms and elongated serpentine snout. She had seen it before, one of the eight creatures carved into the clock tower itself, eight gargoyles she had once sworn had watched her, smiled at her. Was there one currently missing from the clock tower? Or had statues been molded after its monstrosity? She willed strength into her knees. A faint blue light began pulsing from beneath her suit. Shit. The eye. Never a good sign when it flared. Never, never, never. She put a hand over it, smothering the barely perceptible glow. Report, the thing hissed through its mouth of dark stone teeth. Word hound, that's what she would call it, even if it didn't look remotely like a dog. She had a feeling the gargoyle thing could track and hunt just as well as any canine, and obeyed its master well. And then further down it says, the dim light glinting on the iridescent veins running through its obsidian skin. Later in Queen of Shadows 39, when Rowan and Aelin are looking at one of the word hounds that Lorcan had killed, it said the stone skin seemed to be like armor, but the inside of it was just like flesh, very similar to the Illyrian's armor being scale-like. And then Rowan snorted at the name she had coined. So the term word hound is just from Aelin's brain. It's not actually anything to do with the word. It's just in title. It could be something else. We don't actually know the names of the beasts that are in Hue and City. So I just want to say, like, it's not... Word hound is just a coined phrase. She made it up. In Throne of Glass 25, Elaena says this to Selaena: the eight guardians you know of whom I speak. Selaena stared at her blankly, but then understood. The gargoyles on the clock tower. The queen nodded. They guard the portal between our worlds. We have managed to buy some time, but I was able to slip past it. And I just want to point out, before we kind of go back on to Reese, that the watchtowers, the three towers that were used to disband magic, all three of them had black stone gargoyles. These gargoyles were there to guard a rift in Rifthold, and that the Illyrians look like, sort of like, Reese definitely looks exactly like that. And there are gates in Hue and City. There's gates at the prison. There's Ramil. There's the end of the mountain. It's all there. It's like right on the tip of my tongue. But I'm not Sarah J. Maas, so I can't like fully form everything. But I can definitely lead us down the road. So basically, the gargoyles do have wings in Throne of Glass. Reese has wings. They're serpentine, just like Reese. They have this silverly glow in Hue and City. They have these iridescent veins in Throne of Glass. What I think is really cool, well, interesting. I keep saying the word interesting in the podcast, and I like really want to like beat myself every time I edit and listen back. But it's interesting that after Queen of Shadows, the only times word hounds are really ever brought up again is when Lorcan is talking about things either not being word hounds or being different than word hounds, but we never see them in the battle. They don't really ever come back up again after they kind of deal with them in Rifthold during Queen of Shadows. I know my voice is starting to go. It's just from me not using it a lot this past week. I am getting better. I don't know why I'm like sounding so sick today. It's because I'm talking a lot. So I'm going to spare you the rest of this time together and cut us a little bit short. And I will do a whole TikTok with my voice not like this on Reese being a word hound and all that stuff. But I think that's all the evidence I'm going to be putting on my TikTok. So that's all the evidence you really need, is that they look alike. They act alike. Well, not act alike, but they're placed in very similar places. Very suspicious. Didn't catch that until I was doing stuff for this episode. But the last thing that they talk about in this thing is the fourth object of the trove. An ancient bit of bone that's hidden in shadow. It could be protected by the trove spell. Why doesn't Amryn remember it? I need a book on Amryn. I'd like to know what Amryn does know, other than what she doesn't know. And yeah, I think it's probably likely that it's going to be the horn. Now, I really don't have... I mean, we talked all the questions that I have to talk about. We've gone through everything I want to go through. We did a theory. We did a breakdown. We listened to me have horrible voice. So I don't really have much to say other than thank you for listening. I hope you had fun today. I hope my voice wasn't horrible. This is why I keep telling myself when I feel well that I need to do like an episode I can just kind of keep in the folder, so that way if I'm ever deathly sick and I haven't recorded on time, I can just do that episode. But I'm me and I've never done that, and I keep thinking I need to do it, and I probably should have done it, but I didn't do it. Anyways. Next week, we'll be talking about light singers and who I think a light singer is going to be. Somebody asked me to talk about this, and somebody else asked me to talk more theory and less breakdown. So we're going to do two birds with one stone, and then we're going to be on my Instagram. I'm going to ask you guys who I should do first for my character breakdown. And yeah, and that's all I got for you. I'm rushing a little bit to this outro, but it's because I think I'm not going to be able to talk in 5 minutes. My voice might actually go. So, thank you so much. Have a wonderful week. I hope you had fun. I had fun. This was fun. I like talking about Reese because he's just such a dynamic dude. He's such a dynamic dude. And he is chaos. And I love him for it. I know he's been getting a lot of heat in the last, like, month or so. Same with Nesta. Have been getting a lot of heat, and I just like Reese because he's so dynamic, and because, like, I get so mad at him, I want to strangle him. I love him so much, I want to strangle him. He is both of those things, and I love him very dearly for being both of those things. And that's it. Goodbye.